It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A study by Harvard University researchers reveals we're not ready to provide housing and care for a surging population of aging people in Wisconsin and nationwide. We examine the findings about affordable housing and care in the senior years, and you could be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share your insights at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer Molinsky is project director of the Housing and Aging Society program at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Jennifer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your research shows a growing population of older adults with low incomes are eligible for government housing assistance, but they're not getting it. They're not receiving that assistance. What might be causing these gaps in access?
Well, housing assistance is not an entitlement program, and only about a third of older adults who are eligible for it actually receive it. And the rest are, you know, people who are on waiting lists, very long sometimes, or doubled up, or just paying in excess of 50% of their income for housing. So it's a pretty significant problem, and it's growing as our older population expands.
What does it mean for an older adult to pay 30-50% of their income for housing? What does it mean to be cost burdened?
Yeah, that's right. So 11.2 million older adults households are in this situation of paying more than 30% of their income for housing. And especially those who have lower incomes, it often means cutting back on food. We know that people cut back on healthcare, out-of-pocket healthcare, so they might not fill prescriptions. They might be in unsuitable housing situations, substandard housing, that kind of a thing. So the repercussions are significant to health and well-being.
When an aging adult is on a fixed income, can you explain how that is expensive over time as we watch housing costs, keep rising and rising?
Right. So in older age, people on fixed incomes are not immune from rising housing costs, as you know. And so we have a growing number of older homeowners who are carrying mortgages into their 80s and beyond. So, and this means that their housing costs each month are high. They're not, you know, dropping to the low rate that people who've paid off their mortgages can have. Renters are seeing rising housing costs even as their incomes are fixed or even decline in older age. So this is a worrying thing because we know that the population 80 and over is growing very rapidly. We expect at the Joint Center that the households that are headed by someone 80 and over will double in the next 20 years. And this is a time when people need not only affordable housing, but they also need care and supports to stay in that house.
You know, I think you put out this report every couple years, a biennial report. Do you find that the numbers are trending worse, or are they plateauing as you look at the number of older Americans who are in this fix of not being able to afford their housing?
The rate that it's about a third of older households have been in this position for the last five or so years. It's okay. Peaked during the Great Recession, mm-hmm. but the numbers keep growing. And that's just because we have so many more older households. And I think also because we have a widening income disparity. So there are more people who are really struggling to keep up, you know, just like with the population as a whole, the highest earners have seen marked income growth over the last decade. But those who are at the bottom of the income distribution have seen, you know, losses actually in real terms.
We're talking about the need to support a growing number of older Americans. Jennifer Molinsky is with us, project director of the Housing and Aging Society program. That's at Harvard University. You can join in with questions. You can share your experiences at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer, your research shows more government funding could help older and low-income people to cover their housing and healthcare costs. What could be the different roles of state and local government to address these needs for housing and providing in-home care?
Right. So at the state level, state Medicaid programs often provide home and community-based services. So for people who need help bathing or dressing or with upkeep of the home, that kind of thing, shopping, those are not entitlement programs, even though Medicaid is itself, you know, if you're income eligible, you can receive it. But these are extra programs that are only provided, you know, in the same way that housing assistance is really on a first come first serve basis. You have to qualify and then maybe get on a waiting list in many places. So there's room for expanding that. I think the other thing we need to think about at the local level is more housing options. So we know that a lot of people are living in inaccessible housing, that the needs for, you know, no step entry, curbless showers, that kind of thing grow with age. And yet there's very few options for people to leave their single family home that may be inaccessible because that is the least accessible housing type, and move into something else in their community. Barring that, we also need some more support to help people modify their homes.
What is the breakdown a bit of adults who are either living in their home or have moved out to some sort of long-term care assisted living versus another type of sent up or even renting? What do you find there in the breakdown?
Nationally, about 80% of older households are homeowners, and the rest are renters. Those are households, people who head their own household. And we find that the vast majority of older adults do head their own household. So it's most people are living in a home that they own or rent with by themselves or with a spouse. That's the biggest group. Then there's a set that are living in their own home with extended family, so multi-generationally. About 9 million or so folks live in their own home with family. And then we've got another almost 5 million who are living with their children and or other people in their homes. It's a very small percentage. Only 2.5% of older adults, 65 and over, are in nursing homes or other institutional quarters like that. Assisted living is a bit harder to parse out just because that's data the census doesn't collect quite that way. But we know that the vast majority are living in age-integrated traditional communities.
Wisconsin being one of the states that has so far declined federal Medicaid expansion funds authorized under the Affordable Care Act, would expanding the scope of people eligible for Medicaid assistance, would that help the older and lower income people?
Yes, absolutely. It would definitely, because most older adults really have fairly modest incomes, and there's big differences in wealth, of course, but incomes really tend to decline and converge with age. So when you start out looking at owners and renters and different household configurations, there's a wide, you know, range of incomes among people in their 40s and 50s. But over time, they decline and they converge. And the median income for older adults in Wisconsin, for instance, is $45,000. And it's not too different for renters or for owners with mortgages or owners without mortgages. So, so you see this convergence, and so there's just a lot that of need at that level. More and more people will be able to qualify, and we need to support that. But that we would need, in addition to that, the home and community-based services, the part of Medicaid that will support people with these services and supports in their homes.
What are some community-based alternatives to nursing homes? I mean, you mentioned just a small segment of older Americans being in nursing homes or longer-term care settings.
Yeah, right. So we certainly see a growing interest in multi-generational households. So that's, you know, you're living with extended family under one roof. But there's also, you know, some growing interest in co-living. And so that's where people have their own apartment or housing unit, but they share some common spaces and community. And people are really attracted to that because of its community aspect. We see more interest in house sharing. So this is people who are roommates at older age, or and they could be older people living with older people, but they can also be older people living with younger people. And we certainly see that around college towns where that can work really well. We see a growing examples of service enriched housing, which is not quite assisted living, but it's a place where you have your own apartment and there might be meals once or twice a week. There might be a 24-hour presence of staff in case there's an emergency, recreational opportunities, that kind of thing. And that model has really grown up among the subsidized, the lower income residential population. So what we're seeing now is assisted living looking to that model and seeing what they can do to make that work for middle-income people. It's actually harder in some cases to make it work for middle-income people because the lower income is able to take advantage of different housing and other subsidies.
Jennifer Malinsky is project director of the Housing and Aging Society program at Harvard, out with a study on meeting the housing and healthcare needs of the nation's rapidly aging population. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We unpack a new report by Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies that finds our nation is ill-equipped to provide affordable housing and adequate care for the growing number of older people in Wisconsin and nationwide. You can be part of this conversation. Call in with a question. Add your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer Malinsky is with us, project director at the Housing and Aging Society program at Harvard. Jennifer, let's explore this multi-generational housing and multi-generational households and what you're finding. What are the shifts going on here that are leading to such diverse housing situations?
Yeah, about one in five older adults lives in a multi-generational setting, which means they are living with another adult generation that they're related to. And what we see is that there's a growing number of households in this category, especially driven by the increased diversity of the population. So Hispanic and Asian households are more likely to live multi-generationally, and we certainly see that reflected in the data. At the same time, though, just demographically, because we have more and more people in their 80s and beyond, we're also simultaneously seeing this rise in people who are living alone. So it really speaks to very different housing needs, different care situations and the like.
Can you discuss the disparities you found among older adults of color being affected by the costs of aging more than white households?
Yeah, we know that there are significant gaps in income and in wealth. One of the big drivers of that is a big gap in home ownership in later life. So it's a 19 percentage point difference between white older households and Black older households in terms of ownership. But then even among older owners, the equity that is held by each household is quite different. So older adults of color tend to have less housing equity, even if they are also owners, and to have more of their wealth tied up in their homes. So that can make it a little bit harder to access. It's less liquid. And then again, the renters, first of all, have about 2% of the wealth of older homeowners. But then there's wide disparities in that as well with median income or median wealth of renters for Black households was about $4,000, for Hispanic households about $3,000. And, you know, overall, it was $10,000 in net wealth for renters.
You know, as property taxes come due, even if the equity is built up in owning that home, there are also the property taxes that are there. And even I know here in Wisconsin, there are some low interest loans for seniors that qualify. But you know, that too would probably in the future be an issue as people on fixed income may not be able to afford those property taxes rising.
That's right. When we look at the housing cost burdens and the affordability challenges, it's the things that make up your housing costs are your rent payment or your mortgage payment, but also your property taxes, your utilities, your insurance. And we see that people who've paid off their mortgage and, you know, are otherwise in good shape are can become cost burdened and challenged by rising property taxes, by in many places, especially in the South and in places that have seen a lot of disasters, property insurance rates have gone through the roof. So those things can put someone in peril, you know, even as much as housing costs can, and utilities as well. Utility costs are a big one, and a lot of people are you know, utility cost burdened.
Jennifer Malinsky with us, Project Director at Housing and Aging Society Program at Harvard. You can join in, questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Madison. Nancy, hi, go ahead.
Yes, I would like the speaker to speak to the situation for people with major disabilities and the fact that their incomes are super low, like they're way below the $45,000 average that I heard mentioned earlier. They could be $13,000 a year or $14,000 a year, but they might have a home ownership in one way or another. But then they can not have more than $1,999 a month in savings and in checking. So I would like the speaker and other speakers to always include that population because it's way outside of what is usually spoken to.
So Nancy, thank you. Yes, and I want Jennifer to address that. Jennifer, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Nancy. That's it's an excellent point. We do see that the incidence of disability rises with age. So, you know, of course, it's an important issue at all ages, but it becomes a more salient issue among people 80 and over, and that's the population that we're looking at. And so Nancy's point is really well taken, that this is the issues of very low income, accessible housing, the need for services and supports, those are just going to be growing as we see more and more people in their 80s and over with disabilities.
Let's go to Julia in Madison. Julia, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. Thank you. I think there's an issue at hand that we need to look at also as a nation, is that in reading in the Wall Street Journal in October of this year, officials with the State Department of Housing and Urban Development are saying older adults, our senior population, are the fastest growing segment of the homeless population in our nation. And I think that trickles back way back to what are our cities honestly doing to make affordable housing. I personally believe here in Madison, they are not addressing the issue. But I think, you know, we're seeing the greater number of homelessness in the elderly, but I think we need to step way, way back. And what are we really proactively providing for those individuals that can no longer afford to live in their homes, because a big part of it is taxes and the cost of living.
Julia, thank you. Jennifer, can you bring up the issues with homelessness?
Yeah, that's thank you for raising that. We've seen older adult homelessness increase by 10,000 people between 2019 and 2021. It's now more than 60,000 older adults who are unhoused. And I think the important thing is when we're thinking about people who are housing insecure or who don't have housing, we really need to look to younger ages, because the state of being unhoused is so stressful that people present with health issues of someone much older, which brings up, you know, the fact that we need to have different services and different supports for people who are going through this, that they may have needs that shelters just can't provide. Most shelters, for instance, aren't accessible. So it's a really important and growing issue. And to the housing piece, yes, I mean, we have certainly seen here in the Boston area, people who have long time rented their homes, you know, 20 years, they're paying consistent rents, but then their building gets sold, and that flipping of the building leads to some incredible rent increase, and then people become unhoused. And so there's many reasons people become unhoused, but there is a really important housing piece that we can do better at, we can address.
Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. This was a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Jennifer Malinsky, Project Director of the Housing and Aging Society Program at the Joint Center for Housing Studies, that's at Harvard University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Reuters investigation unravels how a high-powered firearms trafficking operation stretches from Racine to one of Mexico's drug cartels. Federal authorities say the gun trafficking network bought hundreds of guns from more than a dozen states, including Wisconsin and Illinois here in the Midwest. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Kenosian is an investigative reporter at Reuters. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Your reporting surfaces this indictment filed in Wisconsin's Eastern District Court describing members of a Racine family enlisting friends and relatives to buy guns for the Jalisco New Generation cartel. Does the indictment suggest why? Why Racine? Why these weapons were purchased there?
The indictment doesn't say, which is why we did the investigation. And, you know, I had heard about the case through a source who also saw Wisconsin and thought, hey, that's weird. so we dug a bit into why Wisconsin, but then as we sort of pulled the thread, you know, we saw it was also other states that were a bit further from the border, which is the traditional kind of conventional place where cartels are believed to get their weapons, and where, in fact, the majority of weapons in Mexico do come from. But what these arms trafficking cells across the United States, including one alleged in Wisconsin, were buying military grade weapons, sort of really more rare, more expensive weapons like 50 calibers and other, you know, SCARs, kind of these larger weapons that were initially designed for militaries.
I was struck by one of your sources said this was in Racine an unprecedented shopping spree. Why is this particular gun trafficking network and this operation that Racine was involved in, why was it so unprecedented?
Well, actually, that line has been misread a bit. It was Wisconsin and then two connected cells, one in Las Vegas and one in Portland. You know, I mean, Wisconsin does have fairly loose gun laws in comparison to other places in the United States. But what we were really struck by in this investigation is, you know, Wisconsin was the first cell that they noticed in this arms trafficking network. But basically, you know, across the United States, one of the sources said to me, you know, owning 650 calibers is no different than owning six toasters in the United States. In comparison to Mexico, which has extremely strict gun laws and one gun store in the whole country.
Yeah, I mean, located on a military base. I couldn't even believe that. I mean, a single gun store in Mexico. Contrast that to here in the U.S.
Yeah. It's a big difference. And, you know, I had a discussion with a former high-level U.S. diplomat who had actually been at the embassy during the administration of President Donald Trump, who said to me, you know, if the shoe were on the other foot and the United States had extremely, you know, strict gun laws and Mexico had extremely liberal gun laws, you know, our government probably would not be happy with the situation.
So how do authorities say these guns were transported out of the country? What is known there?
According to sources, and then just more broadly, you know, in this specific case, they apparently were paying off a border agent to get them into the country. You know, they would disassemble the guns often, hide them in cars. But just broadly speaking, you know, and this is a critique also of Mexican customs, but you know, with the amount of traffic that crosses the U.S.-Mexico border, it's hard to stop every single car. So they just drive them over often times, yeah.
We're talking with Sarah Kenosian, an investigative reporter at Reuters, looking at this federal case linking weapons purchased in Racine and other states besides Wisconsin with this Mexican drug cartel. You can join in with questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah, U.S. federal arms trafficking investigators say the Jalisco New Generation cartel is trafficking fentanyl and methamphetamine to the United States. How are cartel members using these weapons in their drug trafficking?
Yeah, I mean, depending on these specific weapons, sort of heavier weapons, which, you know, the New Generation cartel is one of two of the bigger cartels in Mexico that is trafficking fentanyl and methamphetamines and other contraband to the United States. And here in Mexico, you know, these cartels are obviously very well armed, and they'll use them to intimidate rivals. They use them to take on Mexican security forces. They'll use them to attack high-level politicians. Like, you know, this gun trafficking cell in Wisconsin was actually discovered initially because of an attack that happened at about 5 p.m. in the afternoon in May of 2018. But, you know, these kinds of attacks are quote unquote common, or you see these attacks on politicians, these threats by the cartels. And it was against the former attorney general of the state of Jalisco, which is the home base of this cartel. But it's basically to say, you know, we have the power, we have the money, we can take on the state. And that's pretty much the, you know, that's the big issue in Mexico is what do you do when a criminal group is armed to the teeth with a weapons like 50 cals and can down a helicopter that's looking for its leader, which is what happened actually with this cartel in 2015 with a 50 caliber weapon, which was what this arms trafficking cell was specializing in. So it just sort of gives them a level of power to take on and hold, you know, as much territory as they can get.
Can you explain a little bit further about gun number 31 and the Barrett 50 caliber rifle that was picked up by police in that raid in Guadalajara?
Right. So after that attack that I mentioned on the former attorney general in Jalisco, as connected to that investigation, Mexican federal police carried out a raid on a house in Guadalajara, which is the capital of Jalisco, that they believed and found to be tied to a hit squad that reports directly to the top of the New Generation cartel. And in that raid, they found 36 weapons, 27 of them they traced to the United States. A couple of others, I believe they traced to Europe. I think one or two guns they traced to Mexican security forces. And then there was a handful that they were not able to trace. But in that stash of weapons and thousands of rounds of ammunition, and we're talking, there was like grenade launchers, again, 50 cals, just a ton of very high caliber weapons. In that stash of weapons was a Barrett 50 cal that was purchased in Wisconsin. And investigators were able to trace that gun back to Wisconsin. And once they did that, they go to the store that it was purchased at, and firearms dealers will then give their records over to authorities, and authorities, you know, the ATF, alcohol, firearms, tobacco, and explosives, agents from that U.S. agency that deals with firearms trafficking ended up going to sort of canvassing gun stores around the Racine area. You know, I think in the city of Racine, there's no gun stores, but the county and all around there, they canvassed and found that there had been a rash of purchases of primarily 50 cals, and then this other gun called an FN SCAR.
Sarah Kenosian is with us this talking about this Reuters investigation, latest report showing this connection between high-powered guns from Racine smuggled across the border to a Mexican drug cartel involved in fentanyl trafficking. Call in with a question. You can share your concerns, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Reuters investigation sheds light on federal charges outlining how a Racine family legally purchased military-grade firearms for one of Mexico's top fentanyl trafficking gangs as part of a larger gun smuggling network. Be part of the discussion. Raise a question. Add your comments at any point. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Sarah Kenosian, who's an investigative reporter at Reuters. Sarah, federal investigators say the gun store Shooter Sports Center in Racine sold weapons to several members of the Cobian family. What connection do court documents suggest between this family and the Jalisco New Generation cartel?
Yeah, well, it wasn't just the Shooter Sports Center. There were other gun stores, but it was the only one in the indictment that is still selling firearms. But, you know, the connection, basically the connection between this family is in the 70s, the parents had come from Jalisco to Wisconsin. You know, there's a lot of, and migration is pretty common. They were looking for work and came up and really embedded in the community and had kids in Wisconsin, and then invited some cousins up from Jalisco. And they're from a town called Tonaya, Jalisco, which is believed to be, you know, one of the strongholds, you'll hear it in Mexican media, of the Jalisco New Generation cartel. And it turned out that the head of this arms trafficking network that U.S. investigators were able to uncover across the United States was a man named Jesus Cisneros. And turned out that he was actually cousins with the family in Wisconsin. And that was how that initial link was made. And if you look at the indictment, there is apparently a meeting that happened in Jalisco in around, I believe it was 2017, potentially 2018. And after that meeting, the cousins who were from Jalisco apparently had started to enlist people to buy guns for them. And that's how that connection was made.
And then in 2019, agents with the ATF, U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, conduct this raid on the home of Oswaldo Cobian. And federal investigators say agents saw Oswaldo and his brother carrying two assault rifles into the garage. What did agents report finding?
In those raids, they found it was a five-house raid. They ended up finding 52 firearms, a large amount of ammunition. A lot of those firearms, they didn't expect to be trafficked necessarily. And they also found some empty 50 caliber cases. And in the home of Victor Cobian, they found these two handguns with gold-plated grips. One had this that had carvings in them. One had a saint that's popular with narco traffickers in Mexico. And the other had this gold 50 peso coin that looks a lot like coins that were stolen in this bank heist in 2019 in Mexico, with the letter CJNG carved out underneath. And when I asked Victor about those guns, he said they were his, and he said that he had gotten them made by a gun maker out in California. He said he was a really big fan of organized crime TV shows, and you know, the CJNG was an ode to his hometown in Jalisco.
What charges are the Cobians and others involved? What are they facing with charges?
It's a range of charges from different guns trafficking charges, from conspiracy to lying on the form, because that's when you purchase a gun in the United States, you have to fill out a form and say who the gun is for. And so if you write on that form that the gun is for you and it turns out that it's not for you, that's a charge. In the case of Victor Cobian, if you read the indictment, he was never charged with purchasing a 50 cal, but he was charged with conspiracy charges.
So looking more closely at gun laws, our Attorney General Josh Call pushed for requiring background checks in every gun sale. Would a law requiring background checks on all gun purchases have made a difference in this case?
In this case, you know, when you look, that's the mechanism that these cells were using, was to have people with clean backgrounds purchase the guns. And that's kind of what people look for, you know, to get people with clean records so that they can just purchase the weapons. So in this case, you know, if you were to have done background checks, for instance, and these people have no charges, you know, if there's still no limit on the amount of 50 calibers that you can buy, or, you know, there's not really a regulation there to necessarily stop you from purchasing them.
And that brings me to firearms dealers. Is there any role here or culpability on the part of the stores that are selling these powerful weapons?
I mean, you know, firearms dealers are following the letter of the law of the United States. And, you know, when I went into the Shooter Sports Center, I took a look. You know, the employees were kind enough to share the purchase records of some of the firearms that were purchased, the serial numbers that were listed in the indictment. And, you know, I said, did it ring any alarm bells that they had purchased so many 50? I think it was 4 in a 6-month span. And you know, the employees were just kind of like, it's not illegal to purchase that many 50 cals. And it's not even necessarily illegal that members of the same family did so, because it's quite common for friends and family to recommend a store. And so, you know, and then the owner followed up by saying, you know, they don't condone the illegal movement of firearms. So, you know, I think that there's this, you know, the stores are saying, we're just following the letter of the law. Mm-hmm. And the question is whose responsibility is it? Is it just up to firearms stores to decide what they think is a reasonable amount of guns to be purchased, or what?
We're talking with Sarah Kenosian, who's an investigative reporter at Reuters, as we look at this federal case linking weapons purchased in Racine with the Mexican drug cartel. Still time to talk. You can join in with a question at 800-642-1234. Sarah, the head of the Mexican Lower House of Congress Foreign Relations Committee told you that the financial, economic, and military power of the Mexican cartels comes from the U.S. What is our nation, the American government, doing to disrupt this drug and weapons trafficking network?
Yeah, this has become a flashpoint in relations between the United States and Mexico, and it has been for some time, but it's especially reached a fever pitch with the fentanyl crisis that's happening in the United States, even having some Republican candidates calling for bombing the cartels. But the dynamic here is that cartels are responding to U.S. drug demand. So whether it's demand shifts in demand in the U.S. market, we've seen this from the evolution. For instance, when marijuana was legalized in several states across the United States, marijuana seizures at the border dropped, which is typically a way of you know, seeing an indication of trafficking patterns. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so cartels will respond because they're they deal in supply and demand, their businesses. And so, you know, these drugs are coming up north and the weapons are going south. And there's been a lot of pressure, you know, the Mexican government with backing from the U.S. has been in a drug war since 2006, where they've used the military to try and crack down on cartels. And, you know, you look at the landscape today and you can evaluate for yourself how successful it has been. And so there's this, you know, you have heard in more months greater levels of cooperation between the United States and Mexico about trying to prevent firearms trafficking. There's a lot of focus on the border,
and we have to
in terms of technology.
And we have to end it there. Sarah, thank you for joining us and for sharing your reporting. Sarah Kenosian is an investigative reporter at Reuters. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.